My right leg didn't have, was, I couldn't work. It was inoperable from the all the shrapnel that kicked up. It wasn't just the stuff from the grenade that they used. It was, it kicked up all the pebbles and the dirt and everything else and pierced your whole, my whole right side. And so that didn't work anymore. And neither did my right arm. I had patch about 2 or 3 inches, 2.5 inches in diameter off the back of my skull was gone. Obviously, I had my throat cut now. And I had a big, eventually they had to take out a meter of intestine. I just use, you know, sort of the euphemism, I got slammed, but I really got slammed.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Our guest today is David Holdridge, a Vietnam War veteran, Purple Heart recipient, humanitarian aid worker, and author. His book, Avant-Garde of Western Civ, won the Prize Americana for Prose in 2015. His recently released and excellent second book is Above the Water, which has been described as an irresistible tale of war, madness, love, devotion, and the moral quagmires of American imperialism and international aid. David is a wise and talented man who has had a fascinating career. Back in 1969, he served as an infantry platoon leader with the U.S. Army outside Chu Lai, Vietnam. After being wounded and spending 18 months in recovery, he went on to spend another 35 years working with humanitarian organizations amidst populations suffering from war, exploitation, and impoverishment, including assignments in West Africa, the Middle East, and Asia. I first met David in the early 90s when he was working for the charitable organization Catholic Relief Services, which was run at the time by my father, Lawrence Pizzullo. It's my great honor to welcome David Holdridge as today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
David, tell us a little bit about your background.
When I was a young kid, but looking back on it, it was an incredible blessing being born when I was and where I was. I was born just about the same time as Victory in Europe Day. The end for all, at least the war in the West.
Yeah.
It would be, we'd have to wait to August for the war in the Pacific to finish. And basically, I lived in a small rural town.
Mm-hmm.
We never worried about enough food on the table, but we were country people.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we didn't know we were born into the most powerful country in the history of man. We're just kids out there in the forest and the fields. And I still look back on that with, I want to go back to it so much. Of course, I can't. It was so wonderful.
Yeah.
And I had a best friend there, Dickie Gardner, and we used to get lost in the woods. I used to crawl out of the back of my house under the garage roof and down, drop down, and just spend the night out there doing mock battles in the forest and everything else. We were really creatures of nature.
Yeah.
So my parents were progressive, I guess would be the right word.
Mm-hmm.
And put me through schools, but that's another story, not for here.
Yeah.
And basically, I graduated against the backdrop of America that was very different from my rural town. I graduated against the backdrop of basically black rage,
yeah,
African-American rage.
Yeah.
Selma had been just a few years before. The major cities in the North were ablaze,
mm-hmm,
often, and the counter-revolution, which is basically everything that I had been able to provide me with such an incredible childhood on the coast, particularly. Massive amounts of people were marching to a different tune.
Yeah.
Bob Dylan, Joan Baez,
yeah, yeah,
etc. And they wanted to basically turn over the whole nature of the American experiment. But that's what I came into. And those two things, Ralph, are important, as you well know, because what America was very much reflected in the draft army.
Yeah.
Just a few months after I graduated, I got drafted.
Wow.
I was 1A, lucky me. Holding up my hand, thinking, oh my God, I'm going to be part, you know, of the hegemon.
Yeah.
I didn't use words like that back then, but that was it.
Yeah.
And then swore me in, right turn, out into the parking lot with about 15 other people in New Haven, Connecticut. And the next thing I heard from my new home and my new masters was, all I want to see is assholes and elbows. And they had us policing the parking lot for cigarette butts. So talk about what I had envisioned. Right. And what my first experience was in the Army.
Yeah.
So from there, basically, I went on to basic training and that sort of thing. And some of this is looking back, but some of it was my feelings and many others at the time. First of all, again, I want to say I was with a very mixed company. These were drafty guys.
Yeah.
I had guys in my platoons, they couldn't read.
Yeah.
I remember there was a fire manual, and I was assigned to read it to them.
Wow.
And I had, you know, African Americans who were saying, again, I'm saving myself for Selma.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, or expressions like that.
Yeah.
And then, of course, because they always step forward or have in the past, I had a strong contingent of Southern boys.
Yeah.
And so that's a difficult mix. And who was I? I was a rural kid, a Yankee from New England.
Yeah.
So basically, trying to put that together.
Yeah.
So I went through the basic training, New Jersey, advanced infantry training in Alabama. Mm-hmm. And then I got the option, because I did well in those two short programs, relatively, to basically opt in to be officer's candidate school for infantry.
Yeah.
They were losing an awful lot of second lieutenants, Ralph.
Yeah, I heard that. Yeah.
This is supply and demand.
Right.
So, what the hell did I know, really? I raised my hand and walked forward.
Yeah.
For infantry, not knowing at all at the time, they had the highest casualty rate of any damn soldiers on the ground. And you know this because you spent so much time in Vietnam yourself. So anyway, so I got that assignment and went through those 6 months down at Fort Benning, Georgia. But the thing about that was, and it kept driving me nuts, and not just me.
Yeah.
A lot of people. We weren't preparing ourselves to fight, neither in the Mekong Delta or up in I Corps.
Yeah.
In the mountain. I mean, it just struck me continuously as absurd.
Yeah.
That I spent 70-80% of my time bit polishing the linoleum floor, making sure the creases, the starch was in my fatigues was perfect.
Right.
Shouting all night at a lamppost until it did parade rest. Just to fool with my mind.
Yeah, yeah.
And you put that saying to myself, but I didn't have any real experience in a fighting war.
Yeah.
But I was just saying to myself, Jesus Christ, how is this going to help me?
Yeah.
And I was good
as
opposed to a lot of
these kids. And you're supposed to lead
men
into combat.
And that sort of thing, you know. Yeah. I had a rifle. I had gone through overnights. I had done 50-mile canoe trips. I was primed.
Right.
And instead, I got brasso. And I get reprimanded because I had missed a tile.
Yeah.
And you know, the boots, oh my God, had to die. When I smiled and looked down at my boots, I had to be able to see the crack in my teeth. In the boots. And I was like, how is this going to keep me alive?
Yeah, yeah.
Jesus. Fortunately, Ralph, I got, just by the throw of the dice, luck, I got to the, these in basic and in advanced infantry were just in big long tents.
Yeah.
But here at OCS, we were in these cinder block buildings, mm-hmm. and they had two beds, two, sometimes three in each one. Mm-hmm. The one I was in had two, and my roommate, so to speak, was a guy named James Turpin. And he was very unusual because he was not a draftee. He had already done a tour in Vietnam and a tour as Special Forces, Green Beret. And I remember coming in the first time, dropping my duffel bag. He was putting his footlocker in order. And he had this string on the inside of his footlocker. You know, it had, they look like steamer trunks. You open them.
Yeah.
And it had a row of ears, human ears.
Oh, my God.
And I said, holy shit.
Yeah.
Well, those were his good luck charms that he had brought back from Vietnam with him.
Oh, wow.
You know? And I said, oh, my God.
This is heavy duty. Yeah.
You know? I met some tough guys in my life, but I'm sleeping with this guy. I better not piss him off.
Right.
In the end of the day, he was a godsend. Mm-hmm. He was so good to me. He took me under his arm. And he said, forget all this bullshit, David, except the map reading and how to assemble and disassemble, you know, the M16.
Yeah.
And he said, forget that bullshit. And he gave me, on the side, a wonderful education about how it was going to come down. I love that guy.
Yeah. And he'd been there before, so he knew.
And unfortunately, he went back over, but this time as a lieutenant with the Special Forces, and he got killed.
Oh, God.
And I feel very bad about it.
Yeah,
anyway, he had a wife and two kids that I met at graduation. So, went through the training and then had my first assignment was after OCS, Officer Candidates, going Benning. There was some lieutenant colonel that came down from Washington to interview a half a dozen, because none of the officers tell you anything.
Yeah.
And this guy came down. And I was picked. And I said, I had the audacity to say, for what?
Yeah, exactly.
And he said, you're going to the old guard, the 3rd Infantry. It's the oldest continuous active infantry unit in the Army, history of the Army, American Army.
Yeah.
And it's stationed in Washington.
Huh.
And Washington was burning.
Yeah.
And my first assignment as a lieutenant was to go around in a Jeep with a few other people and try to hold the line, the cordons, around. That was part of our mission, the old guard.
Wow.
They also do Arlington Cemetery, Tomb of the Unknown Soldier, but this was part of it. And go around there. Oh, my God. You know, these are my people. And I'm riding around this, you know, pink-cheeked little young Yankee with never pulled a trigger in his life except in, you know, on the firing line and training programs. And I'm riding around this place, pretty savage environments out there on both sides.
Yeah.
And a lot of these people from the 3rd Guard, they had never seen any action or violence before either.
Yeah.
So I was just saying, oh, my God.
Yeah.
And, of course, it was very divisive. With the people I with, that were, you know, in that unit, because again, it was that division between African Americans and a big contingent from the South. And frankly, it was okay, but it was always one of these things where there were tensions.
Yeah, sure.
Because when you asked an African American to hold the line against his own, because of some of the perceived and real abuse that community had since whatever 1622, and you see that, and you're there, you know, a white middle class guy trying to tell them,
right?
And they held the line.
Yeah,
every single man that at least around me held the line, regardless, black or white,
wow,
Southerner or African American from the urban area.
Yeah,
so that was my second thing. Then, finally, thank God, or as we say in Arabic, Nashka Allah, I got my orders to go to Vietnam again.
Yeah.
There was no trepidation because I didn't know what the hell I was getting into, really, except the newspaper reports.
Right, right, right.
So they sent me to Panama for jungle training. And that, I hate it. This is weird because this whole story about me and war I was just made for that.
Yeah.
And it was basically a couple of hundred guys, about two-thirds Marine, one-third infantry, Army. Mm-hmm. And I and one other guy, a Marine guy, officer, was just for officer corps.
Yeah.
We won the field contest, which was going, it was right along the canal there. It was really heavy brush.
Yeah.
And it was who could get with virtually nothing.
Yeah.
We had a compass.
Yeah.
And getting from one place across the isthmus to another place, then I had to take three people in my team. I was able to be a leader. And who got there first? And we basically strode in to the end point together. And then we celebrated, the two of us. We got a little medal for being that. And that was the water I swam in.
Yeah.
And I hadn't had it for all those months
right.
in basic training and everything else.
Yeah.
And this I could deal with
right.
well.
Yeah.
It was no different in a lot of ways than me and Dickie out in the forest, you know, in the middle of the night when we were 11 and 12 year olds.
Right.
So we did that. And then, of course, we celebrated. I hope this doesn't offend your
yeah.
any of your listeners. We went to, you know, I won't say what it was about, but the establishment was called the Blue Goose. We didn't get back to base till the sun had already risen. And then it got starkly serious.
Yeah.
It's off to San Francisco. The plane, it was a United Airlines plane. Took us basically Okinawa and then into Saigon, Benoit.
Yeah.
And there I was coming down the ramp of the plane and walking towards the big holding areas. And another line just crossing a path, and all of them, you know, were saying wonderful encouragement, you know, like, watch it, you're coming home in a body bag, fella. And all of this stuff, which really made me
yeah.
feel, you know.
Yeah, great. Yeah,
this my is great. My last view of the world is this tarmac.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So we did nothing there for about 3 days except eat, drink too much. There was booze. And check the bulletin board every day, once in the morning, once in the afternoon, to see where we were going.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Chu Lai was a U.S. Marine Corps and U.S. Army military base during the Vietnam War, located roughly 56 miles southeast of the city of Da Nang in the Central Highlands. In 1969, Richard Nixon was president. U.S. forces peaked at 543,000 in April. After the U.S. and South Vietnamese governments agreed to a policy of Vietnamization, U.S. combat troops started to withdraw in June. It was a time when the morale of U.S. ground forces began to fray, with increasing racial tensions and the first reports of fragging soldiers and refusing to fight. At home, popular support for the war was slipping. In October, hundreds of thousands of people marched in Washington and Boston and other cities in a moratorium to end the war. And the next month, anti-war sentiment grew stronger when the My Lai massacre was revealed. 11,718 U.S. soldiers died in Vietnam during 1969.
And so then, basically, one day saw where I was going,
yeah.
got on the C-130, and they brought me up to the airport in Chu Lai. And we had about 2 or 3 days there, Ralph, where we were just getting additional briefings
yeah.
from the permanent party up there. And I remember one thing that just stuck with me again. I know it's retrospect, but at the time, it sort of blew my mind
yeah.
because we were having one of these trainings about reading the local maps, the terrain, and where we were going to be doing our activities, our platoon size activities.
Mm-hmm.
And then this, whatever he was, staff sergeant or something came up and said to us, we're sitting there, he said, we're going to get a guest from the RARVN, Republic of Vietnam Army.
Yeah.
I think he was a major or something. And he's going to come in. And he just wants to address you and wish you good luck.
Yeah.
And there was, oh, that's great, you know, welcome.
Yeah.
And then there was a pause. And he said, I don't want you to discuss anything important in front of him. And I said, you know, because we were down to the terrain.
Yeah.
Nothing.
Yeah.
And, of course, it took a while to click that we were there, but we couldn't even trust the hosting army with anything about what we were going to do.
Yeah.
I went on to work in humanitarian response in war zones overseas. And one of the big things, it's about local ownership.
Sure.
If you want it to endure, you want it.
Yeah.
You can't do local ownership if you're prohibited from even discussing anything.
Yeah, yeah.
With your counterpart.
Yeah.
Because by that time, and I know I'm talking to someone, you were there.
Yeah.
All during this stuff, so you know exactly what I'm talking about.
Yeah. No, the cultures are so, so different.
The Arvins, if they're not owning this.
Yeah. What the hell are we doing?
This isn't going to work.
Yeah.
You combine that, flew me out in CH-47, met my platoon. It had a lot of casualties, as I said, anyway, and one of them I was filling was their platoon leader.
Yeah.
And then, you know, this is just one series for your viewers, probably can't believe this, but it's the God's truth. I just couldn't believe this place. You know, I was expecting some semblance of order and discipline when I got out there. Now, remember, for all your good listeners, this is not the 101st I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is not the 82nd I'm talking about.
Yeah.
This is the Americal. It was disbanded in New Caledonia during World War II, reconstituted. They were changing the nature of their force deployment, DOD,
mm-hmm.
Department of Defense,
mm-hmm.
in Vietnam. And a lot of the units that were incomplete, they merged together.
Yeah.
And put them together.
Yeah.
So it was hardly Ardennes,
right.
101st type of thing. So I want to be clear about that.
Yeah.
So I'm there, and all of a sudden, you know, CH-47's gone. I'm sitting there with these grizzled guys around me and trying. You know, I was aware I had to do something because, you know, I couldn't be absent.
Yeah.
I was their leader.
You're the leader, yeah.
So I was there, and as it turned out, what can I say? You know, it sounds so corny and sloppy and everything, but love conquers all. I mean, we came very close to each other.
Yeah.
But initial things, first of all, I had 4 African Americans.
Yeah.
Big muscular guys, because they had to carry the ammo for these M60s.
Yeah.
And it was hot as blazes, plus their own water, their own seas, and the rest.
Yeah.
And these guys were the strongest I had by far. And they loved it.
Yeah.
They wanted those. All the rest of us just had, you know, are basically M16s. And these guys had the firepower.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So 2 in each of 2 foxholes on the perimeter.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that was great, except, you know, God knows it could have been a bird rustling 50 meters off our perimeter. These guys blew away everything in sight. And, you know, that was the other thing that amazed me, because, you know, Yankees are sort of notoriously stingy.
Yeah, yeah.
You know? Yeah. And these guys, we were going through ammo, but you know what? They just, RTO, they just kept dropping it for us.
Right, right.
You know, it really wasn't a supply. And if we didn't get enough rustling or probes, that sort of thing, then they just as soon fire it off anyway, because they're going to have to carry it all the next day through the 80 degrees, and they know they could call in a resupply.
Yeah.
So there was that. So often, randomly up there, someone from outside the perimeter would shoot 2 rounds, 3 rounds.
Yeah.
And of course, we'd all like this. And that just, you multiply that over the days and over the day, and you get sleep deprived.
Yeah.
Really sleep deprived. Then we moved out on this was the coming of age of that sort of farm boy.
Yeah.
And a lot of others with me. And I had no Turpin. next to me. Yeah. Joe, explain things and help me.
Yeah.
I was out there.
Yeah.
And the only thing I had, the PRC, the radio operator,
yeah.
some jackass in headquarters. No, not headquarters, the nearest fire base,
yeah.
who basically, he had never been close to where we were doing what we're doing,
right,
you know?
Right,
right. It was a rear area MF. I did get to learn about maps mm-hmm. in my training back in the States, so there were very valuable things, because Dickie and I in our forest didn't use maps.
Right, right.
And so that was pretty good, and looked at where we had to go.
Yeah.
And so we set off. And half of my platoon, you know, you talk not army issue.
Yeah.
They had towels around their heads, hood, looked like hoodies.
Yeah.
All sorts of bling.
Yeah.
Gold bling.
Yeah.
All sorts of it. And probably, oh, five or seven, they had tape recorders with them in their pockets.
Yeah.
And of course, my brave machine gunners, because these guys, they were the only real
yeah.
warriors I had out there. Had it plugged into James Brown, going on through the paddies, on the dikes, through the paddies, in 110 Fahrenheit with these hoodies on, lugging these M60s and all that thing. And we were, Ralph, our traveling circus,
yeah.
for Christ's sake. Everything I knew about stealth.
Yeah. Forget it.
Looking for, you know, tracks, you know, finger in the wind.
Yeah.
Everything I knew. We were a goddamn traveling circus. Now, if I had been assigned, like, to TERP,
yeah.
Special Forces, or to a long-range patrol, four or five people, there's none of that.
Yeah.
They have it in their blood. They know.
Yeah.
But that message didn't get through to these platoons. And I'm telling you, one of my biggest challenges was to get most of the guys to take malaria pills.
Yeah.
Because they didn't give a shit.
Yeah.
Do me a favor. Medevac me.
Right.
Honorably.
Right.
I got malaria. So it was an interesting thing. I just called it, so that was the thing. Hideous.
Yeah.
The sound is just like, poof.
Yeah.
The initial sound, poof. Then there's a millisecond, and then there's a roar.
Yeah.
And they've tripped the filament.
Yeah.
And we're going through there, and it's the tripwires. So we've got basically no sleep.
Yeah.
And we're moving forward. And, you know, I love this guy. And he's thin as a string bean, and I think it was from Indiana or Ohio, tall guy, and he was a point guy. And you're supposed to rotate that a bit because it's a very dangerous position.
Yeah.
But he just clung to it.
Yeah.
He had his shotgun, and he was moving back and forth through it. And we didn't hear in the behind him the poof.
Yeah.
But then the roar.
Yeah.
And I was to hear that. So it's invisible.
Yeah.
The invisible filament there.
Yeah.
So you're getting an idea of the context in which I, David Holdridge, it was not born a, you know, platoon leader.
Right.
I was born a mischievous kid whose every family in the neighborhood said, don't you dare play with him. Roaming around the woods.
Yeah.
And now,
yeah.
as I said, this is coming of age.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You have to scoop up the guts and put it in this thing till you get a medevac
yeah.
for him. Nothing is lighthearted from that point on.
Yeah.
My sergeant was deaf from Hawaii. I mean, he had so much explosions and not clinically deaf,
yeah.
but deaf enough.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I had to shout
yeah.
to make myself understood for the guy. And we proceeded. I'll never forget this on this almost fatal day for me, but fatal day for my point guy and for my point. And so we went up this mound, small hill,
yeah.
from the paddies, maybe 50 meters up, scrub around it. And sort of it had beautiful fields of fire, and you know, you could really see a long way around.
Mm-hmm.
And Of course, now I just have to point the finger at myself. It's if it's that I should have said, if that was so damn attractive to you, don't you think the VC knew this was attractive too? But there was nothing down in the paddies.
Yeah.
And the only other way where they used to have these lines of trees between, I guess there are property lines that had trees in them. That was no good. I had to have a place where I could see, but I blame myself. Anyway, we occupied our platoon, what they call, you know, the military ridge. It's like a necklace, but not the top up there. And we settled into some foxholes to pass the heat of the day before we did the last trek, which was going to be to where we would end that day. And then we basically started getting hit with mortars from the tree line. And, you know, I called in artillery support and fire and that sort of stuff. But by the time that stuff came in, again, it's so good to be able to talk with someone like you that spent so much time in Vietnam yourself. You know, and they were gone.
Yeah.
They were long gone.
Right. They knew what was coming.
And they came, you know, basically just raining down tracer fire, barrels of diesel with plastique on it, lots of dead cattle.
Yeah.
You know, but they were gone.
Yeah.
So we were all basically getting pretty fidgety up there and scared.
Yeah.
And I'll never forget this. And then the point guy came over just to, I don't know, chat or talk to me or whatever.
Yeah.
And about 10 feet from me, you guessed it, poof. And a few minutes later, I was dragging that guy over to a medevac. Not a few minutes, 15 minutes, 20 minutes to a medevac, a Huey, and putting him on the deck. And he was gone.
Yeah.
Beautiful. The last thing I remember, I'm getting emotional right now talking about it. Last time I remember is just so you have those beautiful blue eyes looking up at me. And I said later, it's just another of America's best by this traveling fucking circus. And you would think the United States would know if you're working in a jungle environment and things like this, you don't wander around, goddammit, like a traveling circus.
Yeah.
And these VC, they were better.
They're just waiting. Yeah.
Sure. They just need their sack of rice.
Yeah.
Some rounds. Now I'm on the mend. Oh, so I'm looking down at the guy, the point man, and I'm coming back, put him on the chopper, and I'm coming back to my hole. And then, poof, a roar. The place had been, you know, that's why I'll go to my demise. You know, it just shouldn't have been there, even though I could have seen nothing down in the paddies.
Yeah.
Because if it was good enough, they are smart enough to know that's where they'll go.
Right.
And so I just have to live with that.
Yeah, but you're not prepared. You know, I mean, yeah. It's.
I was, you know, whatever. But, you know, I'm not going to sit here and beat myself anymore. But the fact of the matter is, then my sergeant came over and right up close to me, poof, roar, except I was in that blast zone. And that was the bloody end of David Holdridge's field tour with 198th in Maracal up west of Chulai.
Yeah.
And my RTO and this young medic, oh God, what a saint. I don't know where it happened to his instruments. They must give them. So maybe they forgot.
Yeah.
There were so many. It was not what we call a strat unit, you know?
Yeah.
And he just pushed his pen. He took the filler out of it.
Yeah.
And just pushed the fucker into my throat.
Yeah.
And just sucked on it and kept me alive.
Wow.
Basically, RTO got the medevac in. And the last thing I remember when they put me on the deck, there was one of my guys, I don't even know who, I blacked out, but when I came back, I was numb. I was not blacked out.
Yeah.
But I was numb, my overload on the nerves. I don't know the medical terms, and put me back on that deck, Ralph. And this is the thing. I'm going to tell you two things that I've remembered for the rest of my life. The first was that chopper pilot, hands down, you know it, I know it, anyone who has been in Vietnam, they're the heroes.
Yeah.
The medevac guys are absolutely goddamn heroes.
Yeah.
They're coming in, hovering 15, 20 feet over, and you can take those babies out if you're a good shot with an AK anytime you'd like.
Right.
And they were coming in and dusting right off. And when they put me on the deck, and God knows where my helmet was, my metal helmet, but under those metal helmets is always what they call a plastic metal helmet liner.
Yeah.
And that somehow was still on me. And they put me on it, and I remember feet first, and my head was halfway out the door of the helicopter, and basically the helmet liner, part of it was up on the top of my head, the other was down my head because it was a kilter.
Yeah.
And when they put me back against the deck, it squeezed the back of my skull against the hardness of the deck, and it sort of lifted it, if you had a cap on, like half up. And I was out there. And this guy was going hell for leather, and all I had, because I was conscious.
Yeah.
I had no idea, the damage to myself. I couldn't figure things like that out.
Yeah.
I wasn't feeling my hands or anything. I was just, and I had one abiding thought. And as if that helmet liner falls into the paddies, I was going to let go. I was going to say goodbye. Goodbye. It was, that's all. And it didn't.
Yeah.
And I know this sounds scientific, but I guarantee you, I would have just let go.
Yeah.
Let me die.
Yeah.
And it stuck there. He landed. Next thing I knew, he had his big fist, ham fist, red mustache with the thumb up looking at me in the face.
Oh, wow.
And that's the last I ever saw. And then they wheeled me into this Quonset hut, MASH unit there.
Yeah.
Moved me right up to the entrance of it. And oh my God, I've just explained what we went through on a daily basis.
Yeah.
Put me through. Oh my God. There was a woman looking at me.
Oh, wow.
And she was beautiful.
Yeah.
Absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
And she was looking at me, and she just wanted to confirm, Lieutenant Holdridge, I could hear, I could process that. And I don't know how I did it, but because I wasn't speaking because I had a hole in my throat very well, but I managed with, I was told later by her, all sorts of froth, give me a kiss. And it wasn't that I was any lustful mood.
Right.
It was, holy shit. It's soft. She's soft. She's kind. I couldn't handle that.
Yeah.
It was, and then the pentothal struck.
Yeah.
And I was in nothing but excruciating pain. You know how it is when you get mangled like I did?
Oh, wow.
Nothing. Only thing passed to put a water sponge on my lips through the whole thing. And in the end of the day, I had my right leg. I couldn't work. It was inoperable.
Yeah.
From the, basically, all the shrapnel that kicked up. It wasn't just the stuff from the grenade that they used. It was, it kicked up all the pebbles and the dirt and everything else and pierced my whole right side. And so that didn't work anymore. And neither did my right arm. Again, I had patch about 2 or 3 inches, 2.5 inches in diameter off the back of my skull was gone. Obviously, I had my throat cut now.
Yeah.
And I had a big But eventually they had to take out a meter of intestine.
Wow.
For me, and these sorts of things. I just use, you know, sort of the euphemism, I got slammed, but I really got slammed.
Yeah.
From that ship. And basically I spent my time there in a lot of pain, and they really couldn't make much progress. Then I got sent to Japan, you know, for more advanced treatment.
The commander said, "Don't worry, I don't have the authority to kill you today," which was positive for that day anyway.
In 1993, Chris Moon was captured by the Khmer Rouge while clearing landmines in Cambodia. With survival probability low, Chris was brought in front of the boss.
He was just given a local nickname, Mr. Clever.
Hi, I'm Steve Windus, host of the Batting the Breeze podcast. I'd love you to check out how Chris survived, along with some other great human stories at battingthebreeze.com. Hopefully see you there.
In addition to his external injuries, David was suffering from a condition known as Kasalja pain, which is also known as complex regional pain syndrome, specifically regional pain syndrome type 2, which usually develops as a result of some form of damage to the nerves that branch off of the central nervous system, the brain and spinal cord, and send sensory and motor information around the body. Because of this, Kasalja pain can occur nearly anywhere in the body, but usually, and in David's case, in the arms, hands, feet, and legs. People experiencing Kasalja pain typically describe it as an intense burning or electrical pain that persists for months or longer, making nearly any activity difficult or even impossible due to the constant discomfort.
And then this is a thing that I'm very few of your listeners are going to be able to follow, I'm afraid, but it's called causalgia, C-A-U-S-A-L-G-I-A. And it's not uncommon for the type of total trauma that my body had. Mm-hmm. In fact, one doctor said they didn't have a particular name for it, but that our own Civil War, Ralph, had many casualties like this.
Yeah.
Because the ordnance was so crude.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, what is causalgia? The rest of the stuff I was pretty much paralyzed with, except the fingers on my right hand. And those proved instrumental in my recovery, mm-hmm. My fingers in my right hand. And they could, if they wanted to, a nurse, and I always pointed, just they put in this little plug in my neck. If they put their hand on it, I couldn't give the Gettysburg Address, right. But I could say more Demerol, right. Which is what I often said.
Right.
And so basically, I could not. My parasympathetic and sympathetic nervous systems, I'm not a doctor. Yeah. This is the best I could understand, as it was explained to me, were fused.
Oh.
So something that would cause on your hand, Ralph, you're in a nervous situation, imperceptible sweat, maybe. Imperceptible.
Yeah.
For me, that was like putting a torch.
Wow.
You know, right under my palm of my hand.
Yeah.
An acetylene torch, just putting it on full blast.
Wow.
And I just curled around. I just curled around that pain, and it got worse. And it got worse. And what aggravated it just took a time, because I'm like an animal. You stay away from things that hurt you.
Sure.
And it was any light, any untoward noise that came in on me. And amazingly, and don't ask me how this fit into that puzzle, but dryness.
Huh.
Dryness.
Yeah.
So, long story. They got this mangled body back to Chelsea Naval Hospital. I made a couple of stops between Japan and Boston, but Chelsea Naval Hospital there. And that it won't take up too much time to tell, because it was all one day was like the next.
Yeah.
And basically put me in a dark room, and all the shades down, and came in and made sure that my hands were, well, they were completely wet.
Yeah.
But there's a word for it. Anyway, they had sort of makeshift gloves for both hands, and they kept them constantly wet, or they had a bowl on my bed. I could keep them wet.
Yeah.
And they wrapped, swaddled.
Yeah.
They swaddled. That's the word. And they swaddled my feet in wet towels.
Huh.
And would try them, and they had everything dark.
Yeah.
And then she used to just come in, or he, some of the nurses at Chelsea were men, and they used to come in, you know, on schedule, and I knew the schedule like the back of my hand, and give me the shot of Demerol.
Yeah.
And then I used to lie there in my bed. I just had the room all to myself because I was too weird to put a roommate with. And I'd look out this window at this trellis bridge in Chelsea. And at night, you could see the lights. It was quite beautiful, mm-hmm. the truck and the vehicle travel going on. And here, the hand that works. I would crab crawl with my hand up and then across to this little collapsible table right by the side of my, and hit on.
Yeah.
And then I could listen to my generation's music. Mm. I could listen to Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. I could listen to those folks.
Yeah.
And I do that, and I could do the same thing. I know today it's all different, but then do the same thing on that table and pull out a smoke.
Yeah.
I mean, the orderlies would make it easy for me to do that because it was only one hand and a set of fingers. And put it in my mouth and light it with the lighter and take a big drag and then drop my hand over the side of the bed and just let the ashes fall on the floor.
Yeah.
And I would do that for months,
yeah.
just sitting back on Demerol.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, my body looked like something that came out of Auschwitz. I mean, it was literally just skin and bones.
Yeah.
And what had been rather small bed sores, maybe the size of a quarter, they just expanded.
Yeah.
And they became pulpy.
Yeah.
On top of that, my big treat, once a goddamn week, they would put me in a gurney and roll me out to the elevator, and we'd descend to the basement, and I'd lie back. And they had this syringe. It looked like something you use for horses or something. It had about 8-inch needle on it. And then back down, face up, they would put the needle into my neck and rummage around in my spine. And that was filled, that needle, with some sort of anesthesia.
Yeah.
And they would put it in there and they'd rummage around. But it was other stuff they did this. Once a week,
yeah.
they experimented on my neck down in the basement and brought up. Initially, there were some expectations, but it didn't. It wore off.
Yeah.
For whatever, 2 hours? Yeah.
yeah.
But then it came back.
Yeah.
But at that vision of that coming back. So they discharged me. They gave me the prescriptions for Demerol. And my mother had been a nurse in her youth, so in World War II.
Yeah.
Taking care of casualties in World War II in Australia.
Yeah.
And so basically, it took me there, and my mom put me down in the basement of our house. There was hardly any light there anyway, but there was a couple of small horizontal windows that she closed up, and there was a tap down there, and there was a hole there that we used for a sump pump when the water table started to leak into our basement.
Yeah.
And she cut all my food up when I came, and if I had any requests for a change in tapes, she put those in. I used to just piss in the sump hole, and then when I had to take a crap, she would take that out, just like you would with a cat.
Yeah.
And dump it and come back. She, no tear, my father was destroyed.
Oh.
He was so destroyed he was useless.
Yeah. Oh.
She just got to work.
Yeah.
This is what she had done in World War II.
She was used to it. Yeah.
And so basically she said lots and lots of encouragement and prodding and help.
Yeah.
She got my grandfather's old mahogany cane. This hand was okay, the right hand. And eventually I could sort of stumble around the basement as long as I had pieces of posts.
Yeah.
That I could sort of go from one to another.
Yeah.
And that evolved into the hatchway.
Yeah.
And she opened the hatchway and I came out of the, or lifted it up. And this one beautiful, it was night, of course.
Yeah.
Took me up there. She had a bucket of water with her in which I kept my hands.
Yeah.
And we went up and we walked for 10 or 15 minutes like it stumbled. But a lot of the stuff was regenerating.
Yeah.
A lot, not all.
Yeah.
But it was regenerating. And I, from that, within 6 months, I could walk through the woods that Dickie and I did.
Yeah.
Stumbling.
Yeah.
With just a big trench coat on and my hands, my boots, these are like muck boots, full of water so that I could stick my hands in them whenever my hand got dry. And I would just go up and down this wood line.
Yeah.
And come back before there was any cars or commotion.
Yeah.
And come back. So that's how I spent the time. Then my dad, he was doing everything. He found a neurosurgeon at Hartford Hospital. Mm-hmm. Shout out Benjamin Whitcomb. He saved my fucking life.
Yeah.
He took me in. My father never stopped looking.
Yeah.
He took me in 7 hours. Operation, and I woke up on that bed with my mom there, and first thing I did, I put my hands on the dry sheets, and I was prepared. Nothing.
Wow.
Nothing.
Wow.
Sound.
Wow.
Pull the shade up. Now, that was gone. No, there was a residual of trauma.
Yeah.
That whenever I'd see a bright light or leather,
yeah.
I went to grab my hand.
Yeah.
But it wasn't hurting.
Yeah.
But I wanted to grab it. It took some time before. You don't have to do that, David.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
yeah.
not hurting. But it was programmed.
Yeah. Wow.
So I was okay. Then I discharged myself.
Yeah.
And I went to Africa. Now, no one will understand that.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to get so far away from everything, America and everything. All those walks.
Yeah.
And even when, after the snipping, I spent another 6 months lifting weights. I think you know this because you read the book. My father bought me a 14-foot, not much, cool pool.
Yeah.
And I would just swim back and forth and then put weights on my ankles.
Yeah.
And that basically, I could operate okay.
Yeah.
And I put some muscle on, put some weight on. It was a good recovery.
Yeah.
And this didn't hurt anymore.
Yeah.
Now, there's a lot of things wrong with me today because of, you can't take out a meat or a thing. You can't take off part of your cranial.
Right.
Your cranium. But nevertheless, so I did that. And then I came back from what I call my recuperative wanderings. I hitchhiked from Cairo down to Durban.
Wow. Wow. All the way.
Yep. Because you know what? I had to get on with my life.
Yeah.
And I couldn't stick around because every time I saw someone, they were petting me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
we're so thankful.
Feeling
we're
sorry
so thankful.
For you. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And just get me the fuck out of here.
Yeah.
So I did that and I came back and I was sitting in my parents' living room, and there was an advertisement for a war relief. They called it something else, but war relief in the New York Times looking for, and very soon after, I was on a plane to Beirut, which was going through a series of civil wars,
yeah,
but also in 1982, the Israelis invaded.
Yeah.
And they took their, it was a blitzkrieg, and they took their tanks right up to Beirut.
Yeah.
And down in the south along the border, a lot of this is happening right as we speak, but not to that extent.
Right.
They just blew away the Palestinian camps in Lebanon.
Yeah.
Leveled them. And Fatah, the PLO, they all ran north to be in the populated areas of South Beirut.
Yeah.
And that's where they took their protection, there.
Wow.
The Israelis weren't going to go into an urban environment the size of South Beirut.
Yeah.
But they were going to bomb.
Yeah.
And the place, but down where I was on the border still.
Yeah.
I hooked up with a Shia, the sister of the martyred Shia cleric, Musa Sadr.
Uh-huh.
And I said, will you protect me and my staff down here?
Yeah.
And that was a lesson I learned. And she said yes, and she would.
Yeah.
And this is not the PLO. In fact, they didn't like the Palestinians on their land in Lebanon, which most of the world doesn't understand. Most of these Arab countries don't want them.
Yeah.
They got nowhere to go after they got kicked out of Israel. And
why is that, David? Just because they have their own land and they, you know, they don't want, even though they're fellow Arabs, or they don't want them around?
No, they do. But the Palestinians, in their eyes, they're so disruptive.
Yeah.
You know, because first of all, most of them are very secular.
Yeah.
They're better educated. No, it's just the truth.
Yeah.
And they were a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and they just did not want that presence.
Yeah. Yeah.
In very unsettled countries to begin with. Look at the countries we're talking about that have big refugee Palestinians. Syria?
Yeah.
Lebanon?
Yeah.
They're all fragmented and in civil situations.
Right.
You bring these Palestinians in, better educated, more cohesive, and definitely better warriors.
Yeah.
So the weekend before the Israelis crossed the border, June 6, 1982, into Lebanon, over 50 casualties just between the Shia militia and Fatah, the PLO.
Yeah.
They didn't like the secular aspect of them.
Yeah.
You know, and Shia, and just about universally in South Iraq, South Lebanon, are very religious.
Yeah.
So, and they were basically taking over the place. They were ogling their women.
Yeah.
You know, and there was hundreds of thousands.
Yeah.
You know, 250,000 Palestinians in Lebanon today.
Yeah. And the Palestinians are, you say, they're more secular.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, some of the other countries had been equally secular members of the Ba'ath Party.
Yeah.
There until we had the 79 war with Khomeini.
Yeah.
And even though he's Persian, Iranian, he's Shia.
Yeah.
And so for Shia populations, and it's Islamic.
Yeah.
It's not a secular movement.
Right.
It's an Islamic movement.
Yeah.
And I mean, obviously Hamas in Gaza has made a transition somewhat, but there are members of the Brotherhood, which again is a more secular organization. They want power, representation.
Yeah.
But they're not Islamic. So basically she gave me refuge and guarded my house, my office.
Yeah.
And then while this was unfolding up north, the blitzkrieg and the fighting, America stepped in. We got a ceasefire. Fatah and the others were shipped off to Tunisia. These are all long stories.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, I was riding my trucks around with money from the United States government, delivering humanitarian assistance to all the women and children They were now destitute. Their men had all gone, fled to be warriors up in Beirut. Now they're all in Tunisia.
Yeah.
And they were there really pretty much despised by the local population.
Oh, God, what awful.
But not Amal was the name of the Shia organization that protected me, and she in particular. And I went and saw her not long ago just to keep thanking her.
Yeah.
Because she gave us the possibility of helping these women and children and men and protecting them while I was there.
Yeah.
But that was an example of what I did.
Yeah.
But I did it henceforth. I was, if I could say this, I got good at it because I had a lot of the military skills.
Yeah.
And the rest of these people that were doing relief over there,
yeah,
I mean, they were the way I was when I got drafted. They didn't know shit, excuse my language.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They'd go in and I had this one guy, just a wonderful American, Bill, I'll call him, I won't use his last name. And he came up to me in all seriousness.
Yeah.
And he said, David, I said, yeah, Bill. He said, how long do you think it'll take before we develop these people? Because I'm trying to make an arrangement for my eventual marriage. So I just want to know how long this is going to take to develop them. And I just looked at him. Well, Bill, God bless you.
Yeah.
God bless you. But you're not.
Yeah.
Because you know what? We get right back to Vietnam.
Yeah.
Now, they didn't own it.
Yeah.
They've got a culture that's so much older than ours.
Right.
It happens to be hierarchical.
Yeah.
It happens to be subservient, almost 100% to Allah.
Yeah.
And this is a bunch of middle-class Americans that probably haven't managed anything except a lemonade stand in their neighborhood when they were kids, coming over there and saying, basically, we're going to development means changing attitudes and behavior among the people you're with.
Yeah.
So they align with the American narrative and virtues.
In Lebanon in 1982, during the Civil War, David was the Middle East Program Director for the International Organization Mercy Corps, which describes itself as a global, non-governmental, humanitarian aid organization operating in transitional contexts that have undergone or have been undergoing various forms of economic, environmental, social, and political instabilities. Its stated mission is to, quote, alleviate suffering, poverty, and oppression by helping people build secure, productive, and just communities, end quote. As of August 2021, the organization reported to be operating in 38 countries, including Afghanistan, Central African Republic, Myanmar, and Yemen. As I mentioned before, David also worked with Catholic Relief Services and other relief organizations running programs in Lebanon, Iraq, Haiti, Kosovo, Bosnia, Eritrea, the Balkans, Sierra Leone, and the Gaza Strip.
So what we could do as Americans, we could roam the countryside in our deuce and a half, 2.5-ton trucks with very needed supplies for these women and children that were huddled in warehouses, that were huddled in orchards.
Wow.
And everything else.
Yeah.
And we did that.
Yeah. So all you can basically do is put on a Band-Aid on a situation, feed some people, help maintain their lives. But the idea that you're going to solve the problem is just a dream.
Yeah. There's one underlying thing that has to guide you, and I know it guides you, is all human life is equally precious.
Yeah.
And so I'm sorry to say that, but that's about what you could do. You could keep a lot of people that would have died alive.
Yeah.
But to think that you're going to make a better culture because they would adopt American everything.
Yeah.
That culture, governance, you know, economic models. Yeah. That's just... It's not how it's going to happen.
No, and that is an idea that we still can't get over. It still doesn't seem to penetrate our heads. We think that sort of everybody wants to be like us, right?
Right.
And they're going to quickly adapt that. But as you say, you know, they're coming from thousands of years of history and culture. And it probably takes, I mean, you're probably one of the few who understood it.
You go into Gaza, as I used to all the time, and not just go in for a drive-by. Go in and stay a month or so and work with my partners there.
Yeah.
And we tried to get beyond just the provision of stuff there. We taught, like, computer literacy to some of the kids, some of the things that would travel with them.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you, because now we get back to our situation here today in Gaza, the thing that strikes you is they will martyr themselves, these young men, because they're going to paradise, you know?
They know that.
Because this is an Islamic imperative for them. Because why? They use the word, and please, viewers, don't get offended, but this is the word. These are not Jews. This is not anti-Semitism. This is what they call me and anybody associated with Israel. They call us Jew crusaders.
Yeah.
Because what this is all about is you've taken our land. First, the Romans took it, you know, and we were mighty. We were a mighty people.
Yeah.
First, the Romans took it. Then the Catholic Church took it. Then the Crusades took it. Then the colonialists took it. Now you guys are taking it because you Israelis, guys, they look just like Ralph and me.
Yeah, yeah.
They read the same magazines. They play the same sport.
Yeah, it's the same culture, basically.
This is not a Jewish takeover from there. This is another European occupier.
Yeah.
And that's how they see it.
Yeah.
And that land... is holy to them.
Yeah.
It's the Middle East.
Yeah.
And particularly, you know, in places like Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And the temple.
Yeah.
It's holy to them, the Abrahamic faith.
Yeah.
And you're trying to take that from them, all of it.
Yeah.
Because why? Because you, white guys from Europe, slaughtered 6 million Jews. And this is your present to have a safe homeland, which, my God, if anybody in the world deserves it, it's that Jewish population from the years of pogroms and the massacres by Christian people. Sorry.
That's right.
They do.
Yeah.
But they're not seen that way.
Yeah.
They're not seen as Hebrews. They're not seen as Jews. They're seeing another European expansion with Pax Americana.
Yeah.
And we're in there to basically support that occupation.
Yeah.
And so you drive through Gaza and people say, well, will it ever end? After something like we've seen on October 7th, and what you've seen subsequently with the bombings.
Yeah.
All through Gaza, there's posters about 2 feet by 3 feet. And you know what they are? So many of them. I know you have children too, and they're little 2-year-olds and 3-year-olds. And they have the sort of banner across them. And they were killed, and they are now martyrs for Allah. For Islam, martyrs.
Right.
And you think you're going to stop this stuff?
Yeah.
And here you've got these, it just crushes people from our background. You see those little kids dressed up and put on posters.
God.
Anyway, just to finish up, in between these things, I was in Iraq for 6 or 7 years.
Yeah, let's talk about Iraq.
Yeah. So I was there. I've been in most of these countries in war response. Syria I was in as well. So in Iraq, you know, we're right back to Brasso and polishing and keeping the crease.
Yeah.
And these, the troops we sent over there, they were so good.
Yeah.
I met them. I talked to them. I had lunch with them when I went to the green zone, because that's where they huddled. They never spent a day in their life outside the perimeter.
Right.
Not only that perimeter, but
other perimeters. Yeah.
Perimeters.
Bases.
And they were much better than the troops I described in my platoon, even though I love my troops.
Yeah.
I'm talking about according to a military definition.
Right. They were better trained, better equipped. Better prepared.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So this whole idea, I wouldn't get near them.
Yeah.
And finally, Ambassador Hill was the ambassador there. He's out at this, what's the name of it? It's a think tank in Colorado at the University of Zobel or something like that now. He's retired. But I used to see him because I couldn't get any traction with these guys that you cannot go into my villages. They were mine. I was calling them mine down there in South Iraq.
Yeah.
I mean, I had 1,000 employees down there.
Wow.
95% of them were Iraqis.
Yeah.
And, you know, you cannot come down here.
Yeah.
With your shooters.
Yeah.
And driving through the streets at 70, 80 miles an hour with little kids playing ball all over the place.
Yeah.
And a 50 caliber on a swivel in the back of their Jeeps, their Humvees.
Yeah.
So you can't do that.
Yeah.
So, well, we just want to talk to the elders and learn. So, you know, I let that happen once. They went in. I said, well, you know, it's what can go wrong.
Yeah.
He's going to talk. He's a nice guy. He's a captain. He's going to talk. Very nice guy. Sat down. He couldn't walk in to that hooch before 4 or 5 of his guys went through the whole house.
Yeah.
Turned it upside down.
Yeah.
Looking for, how would you like a guest like that in your home, Ralph? 4 guys come in and tear it apart. Now let's have a discussion. That's an asymmetrical situation.
Right.
Yeah.
Now I'll drink your tea.
Exactly. So eventually the ambassador, nobody goes down there without, and I used to meet them, the representatives of the U.S. Embassy and that sort of thing, including Hill, I would drive to them and give them a briefing because this was just going to get us killed.
Yeah.
I said, you're going to get us killed. So how did I travel? Every day, I mean, I don't look like an Arab from the south of Iraq.
Yeah.
So they would dress me up. I'd have a keffiyeh on. I'd have dark glasses. They put me in the back of a ramshackled old car and tell me to drool a bit like I'm sick. And I had the best driver. I hired him. He was a veteran of the Saddam days who used to smuggle all the time everywhere because he's a Shiite. And you know the way Saddam Hussein treated the Shia. It's like dirt.
Yeah.
And basically, so he would dress me. I'd be in the back and we'd go through like, you know, I don't know what he said. Probably he's deaf and dumb or whatever.
Right,
I looked.
Right.
And there was no way they could.
Yeah.
They weren't going to take off my glasses and see my blue eyes and the rest.
Yeah.
And I'd say 90% out of every 10 checkpoints, the checkpoints on the surface were okay. Except they were all impure.
Yeah.
And they all had the flip phones.
Yeah.
And they'd say, we got an ajnabi, a gringo.
Yeah.
We got an ajnabi, just left here.
Yeah.
And that's how it basically, they're there, and that's it.
Yeah.
Down on your knees, put your head to the ground, one after another, bullet in the back of the head.
Yeah.
This is Diyala province for people who know Iraq.
Yeah.
It's really treacherous.
Yeah.
So you get around by being indistinguishable, riding around in dented up cars, having a smuggler there who's going to take you around, and you basically dressing the part. And then what do you have to do in that context? You have none other than Ayatollah Sistani. Ayatollah Sistani was one of the greatest and still is alive. He's very old now.
Yeah.
Clerics in all of Iraq, revered. And it took me 6 months of tea with his affiliate mosques to explain. Yes, I get resources from the United States government, but they are vessels for the American people.
Yeah.
I work for the American people. And I will tell you everything we're doing in Iraq, and I will get your consent before I do it. All subsequent time I was there, it was only one project he disapproved of because he knew the project holder was going to rip me off.
So he's protecting you.
And it wasn't the Ayatollah Sistani himself.
Yeah.
It was his affiliates. And they even issued a fatwa for every single mosque there. Mercy Corps is okay. That was the organization I was working. They are okay. Don't hurt them.
Nicholas Berg was an American freelance radio tower repairman who went to Iraq in December 2003, shortly after the U.S. invasion. He was arrested by Iraqi forces sometime in April 2004. A month later, his decapitated body was found by a U.S. military patrol in Baghdad. On May 11, 2004, the website of the militant jihadist forum, Muntada al-Ansar, posted a video with the opening title, Abu Musab al-Zarqawi Slaughters an American. It shows Berg being decapitated. Zarqawi was a Jordanian jihadist who was responsible for a series of bombings, beheadings, and attacks during the Iraqi war as a means of turning the insurgency against U.S. troops in Iraq into a Shia-Sunni civil war. After proclaiming himself the leader of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, Zarqawi was killed as the result of a U.S. airstrike in June 2006.
His name is Zarqawi. He was a Sunnite.
Yeah.
He was the guy that first cut off Nicholas Berg's head.
Right, right.
And that was what they did.
Yeah.
And basically, he made it clear that every community where we were, because we had several offices, that I was under his protection.
Yeah.
And God help anybody, including Zarqawi's people.
Yeah.
Later on, this rebel Shia Muqtadir Sadr, same thing.
Yeah.
When they came through Muqtadir Sadr rabble down in Kut, Diwaniya, Amara, in that area of South Central, everybody, including the provincial governor, was a Brit. His whole staff, all the other NGOs, these big contractors, RTI from down in Research Triangle, all of these were gone.
Yeah.
They were gone. And they left us there.
Wow.
They left us there. They didn't. I was under his protection. Not just I.
Yeah.
And the other thing I did.
Yeah.
I made sure, as I absolutely had, as few expatriates as absolutely possible needed. And most of those people didn't go out into the field. They stuck in these little regional hooches.
Yeah.
We were only about 6 kilometers from the Iranian border.
Mm-hmm.
And they stayed there. But they were the ones that kept headquarters satisfied with reports and all this sort of shit.
What kind of programs were you running, David?
Yeah, a lot of it was humanitarian assistance. But then with time, we really were big on trying to get them used to the tools that would allow them to function well. We call it modernization, not development.
Right.
And that really centered around, we used to have lines, kilometers long, for what we called our centers of excellence.
Wow.
And they would go in there, and these were computer literacy combined with English, some English, for women only.
Yeah.
But they used to bring their young girls in.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to learn, basically, a little bit of some English.
Yeah.
But more importantly, most of them couldn't read written Arabic.
Yeah.
Very traditional.
Yeah.
So Arabic classes.
Yeah.
Some English for some of the teenage kids.
Yeah.
But the computer, how to work that keyboard, some of the icons, very basic.
Yeah.
We couldn't fill demand no matter how much we put into that.
Wow.
And that would stay with these people. Why? We did all sorts of surveys on the women.
Yeah.
And their little girls, because they brought them with them.
Yeah.
And it's, so we can read the jars in the grocery store. This is
wow.
Basic Arabic.
Right.
Basic Arabic.
Right.
And then for some of the teenagers that were more apt.
Yeah.
It was some basic English.
Yeah.
So they could, what was the second reason the women wanted it? So they could read the subtitles for the Western movies that were being broadcast out of Saudi Arabia, NBC.
Yeah.
Because you know what? You went to jail if you did that under Saddam.
Yeah.
You went to jail if you had a receiver.
Wow.
For any Western. So now they could, but they couldn't even read the subtitles, most of these traditional women,
because
they were written in Arabic.
Yeah.
And there were Western movies.
Yeah.
So they said, that was the second. And the third thing is so that I can teach my daughter.
Wow.
So I can teach her. So those are transformative.
Yeah, sure.
We're breaking down all sorts of stuff, but we're not coming in there and saying, you know, equal rights for women.
Right.
Don't you dare tell that woman not to walk behind you.
You can't do that.
She will walk behind us.
Yeah, they'll throw you out. Yeah, yeah.
Don't screw around.
Yeah.
But is it okay if we can teach them Arabic? If we can teach them some, it all depended on where they were.
Right.
Teach them the keyboard.
Yeah.
Because they just really, it's that innocent.
Yeah.
What's on the label of that can of cherries in Arabic?
Right.
I can read it.
No, and this is for people to understand. Like this is sort of the human side of our government, right? Because you're dealing just directly with people, helping them on their terms, not trying to change their culture or change them or change their religion or make any judgments one way or the other, just saying, hey, you know, from the goodness of our heart and the abundance that we enjoy, we're going to share it with you.
Right.
And I mean, it's so interesting because you're doing it in conjunction with the military side of our government, which is taking a completely different approach.
They're working with contractors, which were nearly all corrupt, and they're paying them with brown paper bags full of cash.
Yeah.
To do this. And we, our legacy.
Yeah.
That was more, I'm afraid, than our legacy was corruption.
Yeah.
And because they had their metrics, you got to get this bridge done. You got to get a new school over there.
Yeah.
Ours was, we don't do anything without the religious authority signing off on it.
Yeah.
Number one. Number two, we keep a very low profile.
Yeah.
They love basketball, the young boys in this town called Coot. And so I said, shit, let's make a good basketball backboard and rim for them.
Yeah.
So they can do it. That was more than any of this other shit.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
That you could do.
Yeah.
Let's have these moms, as I said, be able to read those subtitles of Western movies.
And they'll never forget that, probably. That will have an impact.
Tell their children what's happening there.
Yeah.
And so it was this whole, I refused to let the word development come out of my mouth or my staff. I said, we are modernizing. Because if they don't have these skills, they're never going to be able to keep up with the rest of the world, or we'll always exploit them.
Yeah.
So those are the type of more development things. And then there was, as I mentioned, sometimes just the flat old humanitarian assistance. And you know, I got to tell this story because I'm too old to get in trouble for it. Our last convoy to the Palestinians that had been scattered by this blitzkrieg in 1982. I said, we're really going to do it. Guys, this is to my Palestinian stuff. That was an expression my grandma used. If you did something up brown, you should wrap your presents in brown paper bag. This is back in the 1880s, 1890s. My grandma. We're gonna go out and shop around and look at me.
Yeah,
there's always been commodities and the rest.
Yeah.
So basically, we're there in the courtyard, in Tyr, Tyr, however you want to pronounce it, southern Lebanon, and our deuce and ass rolled in, about six of them, as they always did. And then I'd get in the cab of the front one, and the other guys would get around. And we go off and meander to these various places we knew where they were huddled. Groups of 10, yeah. 12, 20, but dispersed.
Right.
I says, this is, we're running out of money, Ms. Grant. We're going to really do it upright. So we pulled the truck in. They didn't know what I was talking about, my staff. We got there. We sent someone in first. Is it all right now? Because the Lebanese could make trouble for us that they weren't getting it. This was only for the victims of Palestinian. So then they brought three or four, 10, 11, 12-year-old, the other, any older, they were up in Beirut with Fatah, with PLO.
Yeah.
Brought them over the back of the truck, and they were going to bring this stuff in. That was the schedule. They knew the schedule.
Yeah.
Pulled back the canvas flaps on the back, and there was red and white. 2.5 tons of Marlboros. Marlboros. And the place went mad. They were so happy. Every single Palestinian, the women, the kids don't smoke, but the women and the old men, if there's anything you know about that culture, it's the value of a cigarette and a coffee. And they were in such misery. And we pulled back that flap, and we started bringing in these cars. And they all said, before their sort of enthusiasm was muted, oh, this is you're just throwing us crumbs. We know who gives money to the Israelis, blah, blah. And they all stood up, and they started coming. He said, you okay, okay, you okay. And I said, shut up, because we're in a Lebanese community. We drove away, and we reported all of that in our official report. Because you can imagine, the American USAID wasn't about to laud distributing cigarettes and coffee to these poor people. And that was the happiest I ever saw them. And unfortunately, our money ran out at a certain point, but it was I've combined Iraq with Sistani. Yeah. But those were the types of things that we tried to do, you know, was modernize where there was demand. It's always find demand and then check it with the most revered and respected people before you go forward.
Yeah.
And then the rest was based in the end. I know this sounds like I'm patting myself on the back, but I'm not. I really honestly am not. We were the only organization working freely with no arms on our perimeter. No arms. You put arms on your perimeter, guess what? Come, you know, bring it on. Bring it on.
Yeah.
You do
that,
you're finished because you're not going to compete.
Right.
Believe me.
No.
So no arms, whistles. Whistles to wake me up. I slept on the roof of this hooch on the border there. And I said, basically, that's the way we lived. Get blended, get the personal people there, and then find out what the demand is. And you know what? We were the only NGO outside that the Green Zone and the other equivalent perimeters working free like that. The only one.
Yeah.
I know this sounds terrible, and a lot of people have war stories, but I know who did what. I was there for 7 years.
Yeah.
Sleeping on that roof on the Iranian border.
Right.
And I can tell you they weren't there. And this is not pats on the back or pounding the chest. Right. This is just to get that. Right. That's the way you do development. Revered leaders sign off, demand, give them what the goddamn demand is. Everybody else, they just put all these plans. Detailed plans for 2 years in Washington and say, here are your metrics as they go. And you know, I think it was McChrystal. I guess he was a real good Army guy.
Yeah.
on the ground in Afghanistan, got in a lot of trouble. But,
yeah.
You know, in the end of the day, Ralph, he said, and it's been said by military leaders for centuries, it's these plans are wonderful to the first bullet.
That's right. That's right.
And these plans, with all their metrics,
right,
pages and pages of them and tick boxes, useless.
Yeah.
Absolutely useless.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you got to understand what's going on the ground. Yeah.
And give me the liberty to meet demand. You know what? Yeah. You know what? In one mouthful, it is all about being good at this business. It's really a situation of, you know what you are out there? You're not a development relief worker, David. You're not a humanitarian. You know what you are? You're an analyst and investor for the American people.
Mm.
And you are trying to give that investment money for what? For the way that will heal when it's emergency assistance, like we talked about in Gaza? Or if it's development, these skills that there's evident demand, 2 kilometers long, those lines, for those women and kids to learn their own language, you know?
Right.
And that's what it's about. You're not about those other things. And there's another side thing, too, that I'm just putting it all on the table. I don't have anything to lose at this point. But make a good relationship if some of these ambassadors are not worth it.
Yeah.
But there are
yeah.
some really good ones. And get a good relationship there so that you can drive right past the bureaucracy under them in country. I never went through all that bullshit in the Green Zone. I just went and saw Ambassador Hill. We had a long talk. It was a couple of times a day. I'd rather you didn't do that. But you get him backstopping you, and you get a good message. That's important, too.
Yeah.
The other thing is at headquarters, all the international NGOs left Iraq after Nicholasburg.
Yeah.
All of them. Too dangerous. It's too complex. We don't know what we're doing there, you know, as far as why of the war and all that sort of stuff. So they basically all left. SAVE left, CRS left, CARE left. Left with some Jesuits, some friends, Quakers, you know. Some of these folks who are just, you know, they're pure. I'm a sinner. These guys are pure. This is what they do. There's kindness and embrace your fellow man. But the only large one, and that was the thing with my headquarters. You know, I hate to be so crass because we're trying to save lives or educate people there and do our best. But the fact is, the revenues that we were bringing in, because we could spend them and we could suspend them in a way that was sustainable.
Yeah.
Salve or transformation were our two words. Either salve for the people that got hurt and didn't have meat, transformation with some of this other stuff I was talking about. And basically, at one point, we accounted for more than 60% of the revenues of the whole organization.
Wow.
The whole organization. And when you get that, you more or less can tell headquarters what you're doing.
Yeah.
What headquarters,
just leave me alone, basically. Yeah.
No,
yeah.
Because, you know, we're paying an awful lot of bills there back in headquarters. And I had some really good people in headquarters. Not all of them.
Yeah.
But they appreciate it. But they put one thing on my head, Ralph.
Mm.
David, you lose somebody, we're closing up. Like all the others. You lose somebody? Well, I'm happy to say in 7 years, six years and 9 months there, I only had one person hospitalized. One.
Wow.
And that was for shrapnel and Amara.
Yeah.
And within a week, they were outpatient getting treatment. That was it.
Wow.
And we had about 1,000 people all the way up to Kurdistan, Suleimania, Erbil, Dabandakan, and Badr. I know, Diyala.
Yeah, wow.
And so, you know, there was a lot of stress for me.
Yeah, I bet.
And I didn't sleep too well.
Yeah.
For 7 years because And never be complacent about that, you know?
Yeah.
And that sort of situation. You're responsible.
Yeah.
For those people's lives. So don't get carried away so much. You know what the Army tells you, but they never tell you which comes first, men or mission.
Well, it's interesting, looking over the trajectory of your service to humanity and to country, there's definitely like a strong theme there. You know, you went to Vietnam like to serve your country. You saw that your country wasn't really serving itself well or treating itself well. And you found a way over your life and over your career to use the assets, the best of the United States and the best of American people, to serve people in need in the worst situations in the world effectively. You know,
right.
That's a really remarkable thing, David.
Well, thank you. I mean, it's difficult because it's not doing just transferring the American narrative to the Arabian Peninsula or other places. This holds true, whether it's East Timor or Nigeria. It's basically, you've got to seek demand there.
Yeah.
But you've got so many bureaucratic practices and policies in place.
Yeah. And prejudices and
right. It's all about metrics and metrics and stacks of paper. And you know what? McChrystal, I didn't know him, but it all is on context.
Yeah.
And as he said, all your plans are out the window with the first book. Does that mean not plan? No, it means plan, but plan for chaos.
Right.
Plan for right turn.
Yeah.
And always grounded in local demand and local authorities.
Yeah.
Or you're just going to be seen as another occupier. And we all know what happened when we left Afghanistan after, what, 20 years?
Yeah.
Zero ownership.
Yeah.
Zero ownership.
No, horrible, awful.
So, you know,
yeah,
that's the lesson over there. And, you know, United States Army, you know, get a Boy Scout manual about how to live in the woods as a 12-year-old and the rest of stuff. Don't take the hunt completely out of our damn soldiers out there.
Right.
I don't believe that's the case with the special forces or special ops.
Well, they take a whole different, a much more approach like your approach. It's sort of like building relationships in local communities and, you know, helping, fixing teeth and taking care of children and women. And as you pointed out, like, these are long generational commitments. You know, you can't just go in a year and expect to win over a people and have any kind of positive impact. It's not going to happen.
Like my friend Bill, I got a wedding in about 7 months. Do you think we'll be done here? You gotta love it.
David's new book, The Water Above, bravely chronicles the journey of a man who is trying to make sense of America's role in the world, raise a family, and lend aid to the victims of the violent civil war in Lebanon, all at the same time. It's also the story of an idealistic young man intent on advancing the best of American values. What he meets along the way in Vietnam, Connecticut, Lebanon, and in the offices of relief agencies throughout the Middle East is intense, frustrating, and heart-wrenching. I recommend his book highly, and I thank David for his insights into how our foreign policy often helps create and support conflicts, while the humanitarian organizations we support function to mitigate the resulting damage, leaving citizens of our great nation and people all over the world confused and frustrated. It's my great honor to name David Holdridge today's hero behind the headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.